In the Zen sect, the primary emphasis is, of course, Zazen, sitting Zen. That is the cornerstone of our practice. Zazen develops samadhi, the still and silent mind. And we do koan study. Working with koans develops prajna, transcendent wisdom. But it is also important to become familiar with other aspects of Buddhism. In this center and in this lineage, we study the 16 bodhisattva precepts, both as part of our every-minute Zen mindfulness practice, and later on in our training, we work on them as koans. Every November, we have the ceremony of Jukai, in which we commit to the practice of the precepts. We also look at other aspects of doctrine. In the talk and discussion sessions that we have every third Tuesday or so, we've looked at the precepts, the Eightfold Noble Path, the seven factors of enlightenment, the five hindrances, the four abodes, the six unenlightened realms, and on and on. And we will cycle through them again and again. But there is another aspect of our study of Buddhism that is still somewhat neglected, and that is the sutras. There are a couple of sutras that we chant on a regular basis, the Makahanya Haramita Shingyo, the Heart Sutra, and the M.A. Jikku Kanongyo, the Kanon Sutra. But one of the most important scriptures from the standpoint of Zen, and very highly respected by Zen teachers and practitioners, is the Diamond Prajna Paramita, called the Diamond Sutra. There are several quotes from the Diamond Sutra that we use as introductory koans, and another quote shows up in case number 97 in the Hekigan Roku, the Buka Cliff Record. The Diamond Sutra is relatively short and can be read in a matter of half an hour or so, but it is also a very subtle and difficult teaching. I have no idea how many times I've read it in different translations and how many times I've read various commentaries. Recently, I've taken it up again as part of my own practice, and in doing so, I've developed this series of five teisho on the Diamond Sutra for this session. But first, what is a sutra? The sutras are said to be the discourses of the Buddha. But they are much more, and at the same time, much less. We cannot look upon a sutra as any kind of a verbatim record. For one thing, the Buddha spoke in the local vernacular of what is now northern India and Nepal. For another, the sutras were originally part of an oral tradition. None were written down until a couple of hundred years after the Buddha's passing. Since then, the teaching has traveled through many countries, cultures, and languages. So if not the words of the Buddha, what then has come down to us? The word sutra is Sanskrit, meaning thread. It's where we get the English word suture. A sutra is not just a bunch of words and talks given by someone who lived around 2,500 years ago. A sutra is the thread of the Dharma, the teaching. This Dharma thread runs through all time and all space. The words have never been other than fingers pointing at the moon. Regardless of language or country, we have to look past them. Reading words, you should grasp the great reality, says Sherdo, in Identity of Relative and Absolute. The Word adapts and evolves according to times, cultures, causes, and conditions. The teaching remains the same. Later practitioners present their own visions and revisions, and if they come from the practice and realization of the Buddha, they are nonetheless true teachings. Thus we have the Platform Sutra of Wei Nung and other records of the great Chinese masters, the writings of Dogen, and all the sayings and doings of our ancestral teachers. So what constitutes a sutra, an authentic teaching? The Buddha himself was completely pragmatic. Here's the Buddha speaking to Prajapati, the Buddha's foster mother and aunt, whom he addresses as Gotamid. Of whatsoever teachings, Gotamid, thou canst assure thyself thus. These doctrines conduce to passions, not to dispassion, to bondage, not to detachment, to increase of worldly gains, not to decrease of them, to covetousness, not to frugality, to discontent and not to content, to company, not to solitude, to sluggishness, not to energy, to delight in evil, not to delight in good. Of such teachings, Gotamid, thou mayest with certainty affirm, this is not the Dharma. This is not the Vinaya. This is not the Master's message. But of whatsoever teachings thou canst assure thyself that they are the opposite of those things that I have told you, of such teachings thou mayest affirm, this is the Dhamma, this is the Vinaya, this is the Master's message. It is of no concern where the teachings came from or who spoke them or in what language, only that they be genuine. When the Buddha's early disciples went out to spread the Dharma, they did not simply recite the words of the Master. They had to deal with whatever situation, culture, and language they encountered. And that is just as true today. Zen teachers today are constantly trying to find ways to express the Dharma that resonates with a postmodern, post-industrial culture. All true teaching is the Buddha's teaching. But ultimately, it is up to each of us to decide. That doesn't mean capricious or arbitrary cherry-picking of whatever parts happen to appeal to us, but a decision that comes out of our own practice realization and in the light of study with our own teachers. We're never off the hook. Zhao Zhou said, wash your bowls. That is his sutra. Yun Men said, grits. That is his sutra. Zhao Zhou also said, Mu, another sutra. Mu is as much Zhao Zhou as his blood and his bone. Thus it is with the Diamond Sutra. It is the blood and bone of Buddha. This sutra is Buddha nature. You yourself are the same. Whenever you come forth from that place of no abiding, whether in Doksan or in your life, that is your sutra, your Dharma thread. Prajñātara, the 27th Indian ancestor and the teacher of Bodhidharma, said, I am always reciting millions and millions of scrolls of sutras. Even as Mu, or One, arises with each breath, this thought, this sutra that the Buddha speaks, arises at the very moment he articulates it. When the wind blows or the sun shines, experience it. Let it in. It's also true of this sutra. Don't compare yourself to it or go off on a series of speculations about it. It is in itself practice realization. The Buddha is not just saying something that is true. Buddha is the truth of this moment. Our chanting, our zazen, when done wholeheartedly, is the truth of this moment, a truth that does not stand against falsehood. That, too, is our sutra. Historically, the Diamond Sutra is one of an enormous complex of scriptures called the Mahayana, or Prajnaparamita. The Mahayana scriptures were not part of the original canon of Buddhism. They began to appear somewhere during the first century of the Common Era, and they continued to evolve over the next few hundred years. This puts us in a difficult position. There is much to be learned from the Diamond Sutra, but it is unfortunately a bit of a slander on the arhats of the Buddha's time. It was a contention of the Mahayanists that the arhats were the individually enlightened ones, those who went off and got beyond birth and death for themselves only. The second noble truth states that dukkha, suffering, stems from thirsting desire. And that desire is often described as the desire for fame, riches, sex, and so on. But the desire for separate, individual fulfillment, even enlightenment, is just as much a self-centered, self-promoting desire as what we think of as worldly desires. On the other hand, the Mahayana ideal was the Bodhisattva, who vows to liberate all beings. As Robert Aitken liked to say, we're all in this together. But the distinction, at least in the Buddha's time, is not real. Scholars such as Sangharakshita contend that the only difference between those arhats and the Buddha himself was that while the Buddha attained full enlightenment on his own as the pioneer, the arhats did so under his instruction. The Buddha exhorted his earliest disciples to go forth and preach the Dharma for the profit of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, the profit, the happiness of gods and men. He continued, there are beings, but with but little dust of passion on their eyes. They are perishing through not hearing the norm, the teaching. There will be some who will understand. Not exactly the individualistic picture we get from the later Mahayanists. The story of Purna is a specific example. Purna expressed a desire to go out into the world as a missionary and preach the Dharma to others in order that they might be saved from misery and despair. Where, Purna, do you wish to go? Asked the Buddha. I would dwell in the district of the Shrana Parantakas, O Lord, replied Purna. But Purna, the Shrana Parantakas are hot-tempered people. They are violent, cruel, reviling, furious, and abusive. If the Shrana Parantakas meet you with insulting and angry words and curse and abuse you in their fury, what will you think? If they do so, Lord, I shall think that they are surely good and kind men, they who address me with insulting words, they who are angry and curse me, but do not strike me with their fists nor throw rocks at me. But suppose they do strike you with their fists and throw rocks at you. What will you think? I shall think that they are good and kind men, answered Purna, since they do not attack me with clubs and swords. And if they attack you with clubs and swords, I shall think that they are good and kind, since they do not kill me. And if they kill you, then, Lord, if they kill me, I shall certainly think they are kind and good, since they deliver me with so little trouble from this vile body. The story goes on to tell how Purna was extraordinarily successful in converting a cruel and violent people with his guileless and patient love. How much more bodhisattva do we need here? It is said that the Buddha himself spent 8,000 lives as a bodhisattva before his final rebirth as a fully enlightened one. The Buddha was the greatest of bodhisattvas. It's inconceivable that he would somehow neglect to pass that on to his own disciples, or that he would have held back some aspect of the teaching, only to be parceled out to future generations. In preparing these talks, I've used several sources, both for translation and for help in commenting on this sutra. We're dependent on the Pali, Sanskrit, Tibetan, and Chinese versions, and of course on the translators. We owe an enormous debt to people like Edward Kanza, R.H. Blythe, the Cleary brothers, John Blofield, Burton Watson, Red Pine, Kazuaki Tanahashi, and many, many others, dedicated scholars, many of whom are serious practitioners as well. However, in looking at the various translations, it's very clear that there's a lot of ambiguity and subtlety of meaning that's extraordinarily difficult to render into English. Different translators use different terms in different ways according to their own view of what's important. And not being a scholar of ancient languages, I have no way of knowing which is correct. But I'm not approaching this as a scholar, this sutra, but as a Zen student. I'll be using a version of my own concoction. I will use terminology that is favored by some and not others, and some that are used in none of the versions I've looked at. I want to convey as best I can the subtleties of translation or symbolism, but the spirit of the sutra. So this version is a composite with a little bit of fiction thrown in. The Diamond Sutra was originally one continuous document. It was divided into 32 sections or chapters by Prince Zhao Ming. Oddly enough, Zhao Ming was the son of the Emperor Wu of Liang, who had the run-in with Bodhidharma. We'll speak more about that later. Nevertheless, Zhao Ming's chapter divisions have been accepted by many as being a logical way to organize the sutra. For this first series of Taisho, we'll deal only with the first 13 chapters. As for the later chapters, there is some disagreement over whether they were part of the original sutra or possibly later editions. Hopefully we'll be able to take them up at another time. One characteristic of this and other sutras is that the Buddha is addressed in many ways with many titles. Buddha, Arhat, Bhagavan, Tathagata, Sugata, World Honored One, Fully Realized One, Fully Enlightened One, The Awakened One, The Perfect One, and on and on. To simplify things and to be consistent, I'll follow Red Pine's usage. When the sutra itself refers to the Buddha, it will be as the Buddha. When the Buddha is addressed directly, it will be as Bhagavan. When either Subhuti or the Buddha refers to the Buddha in the third person, it will be as the Tathagata. In our study of the Diamond Sutra, we have to look at it as a parable, a Socratic dialogue in which Subhuti, one of the Buddha's most senior disciples, is cast in the role of an earnest seeker whose understanding is not yet complete. And the Buddha, as the teacher, corrects and guides him to a deeper realization. In this, Subuddhi can be said to stand in for all of us. His questions are our questions. His confusions are our confusions. So, let's look at this sutra together. Look, listen, let it in. Let us enter wholeheartedly into this great mythic drama. Let us say that these are the words of the Buddha, for they are indeed the words of Buddha, our own nature speaking to us. Chapter 1. Thus I have heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying in the Jetavana Park near the city of Shravasti with a gathering of 1,250 monks and great bodhisattvas. One day before the noon mealtime, the Buddha put on an outer robe, took a bowl, and entered the city to beg for food. After begging from house to house, he returned to his original place. After eating his meal, he put away the robe and bowl. He washed his feet and spread out a mat, crossed his legs, adjusted his body, and turned his attention to what was before him. A number of monks approached the Buddha, made obeisance, and sat down to one side. That's the end of the chapter. Thus I have heard. All the sutras begin with this statement. According to tradition, Ananda, who was the Buddha's attendant for many years, had perfect recall. And at the first convocation of disciples after the Buddha's parinirvana, he recited all the sutras. So in order to be clear that the words were not his, but those of the Buddha, he began with, "Thus I have heard." One day before the noon mealtime, the Buddha put on an outer robe, took a bowl, and entered the city to beg for food. After begging from house to house, he returned to his original place. After eating his meal, he put away his robe and bowl. He washed his feet and spread out a mat, crossed his legs, adjusted his body, and turned his attention to what was before him. If one were truly able to see and understand what was happening here, we could end at this point. The teaching is finished. Or, the teaching has no beginning and no end. The Buddha does ordinary things, things that any monk does. Is there a difference? In one sense, no. But for those who can see it, it is the difference between heaven and earth. What is the Buddha showing us? One could spend a lot of time parsing out the significance and symbolism of each of the Buddha's actions, putting on the robe, begging from house to house, eating, taking his seat. But what is really happening here? What is the point? Why does the sutra start out with a day in the life, an event that has been happening pretty much the same way, every day for years? What happened on this day? Xiang Yin tended a grave. One day, while he was sweeping, a rock struck a bamboo stalk and he woke up. Had he never heard such a sound before? The Buddha saw the morning star and came to awakening. Had he never seen a star before? It isn't the sound or the sight. The Buddha said, "Constantly I expound and preach the law. Never have I done anything else. Coming, going, sitting, standing. Never to the end growing weary or disheartened." when the truly settled mind is doing the most ordinary things. This is the true teaching. A number of monks approached the Buddha, made obeisance, and sat down to one side. A practitioner breathes mu the same way over and over for years. And one day, something happens. The practitioner reaches a certain point and there's a change. That's all. Why now? No one can know. Something happened on this day in the Jetavana Park. Subhuti and a group of monks approach and take their seats near the Buddha. They saw something. Something that they hadn't seen before. Something had changed. And that change is what drew them to the Buddha. Chapter 2. At that time, the elder Subhuti was in the assembly. He got up, bared his right shoulder, knelt down on one knee, and joined his hands in gassho and said to the Buddha, "It is so very rare, Bhagavan, how the Tathagata protects and cares for the bodhisattvas, and how well he teaches all bodhisattvas. Even so, Bhagavan, if a good man or a good woman should take the bodhisattva path to enlightenment, how should they live? How should they stand and walk? And how should they control their minds and thoughts?" The Buddha said, "Good, Subhuti, very good. It is as you say. The Tathagata protects and cares for the bodhisattvas and teaches them well. Listen with full attention, and I will tell you how good men and good women who take the bodhisattva path should live, stand, and walk, and how they should control their minds." Subhuti answered, "Yes, indeed, Bhagavan," and gave his full attention. Subhuti is the spokesperson. He is one of the Buddha's most senior disciples, both in age and in level of understanding. He gets up, kneels before the Buddha, pays homage, and begs for instruction. "It is so very rare, Bhagavan, how the Tathagata protects and cares for the bodhisattvas and how well he teaches all bodhisattvas." One commentator suggests that Subhuti sighed. I would guess he might even have been in tears. Those who have sat Sesshin and suddenly come to see clearly will recognize this. What did Subhuti see? He saw the Buddha for the first time. Or rather, he saw Buddha. In the simplest, most common, everyday activities, he saw Buddha nature, his own nature, and the nature of all things. Subhuti had accompanied the Buddha on begging rounds in many places for many years, taking it all for granted. But not this day, and never again. When one has had a genuine awakening, the world is suddenly made new. The Buddha taught in many ways. Over his career of 40-odd years of teaching, he formulated and reformulated his teaching many times, and as we can see from the many sutras, as near as we can tell. And that teaching continues. Endlessly patient, the Buddha teaches every moment, just as the sun shines or as a cloud gives rain. The teaching goes beyond words. The Buddha's very presence is a teaching. Buddha is teaching, here and now. It has been said that each one of us is a teaching, whether we know it or not, whether we want to be or not. Those who would walk the bodhisattva path are and must be fully aware of that. Know that every action is Buddha's action. Every word is Buddha's word. All beings are by nature Buddha. So very rare. So wonderful. How Buddha, the Tathagata, our own nature, takes care, even as our practice is taking care. Take care of the practice, and the practice will take care of you, it is said. But how many of us really believe it, and how many of us really live out of it? But it is not yet complete. Subhuti must ask further. Even so, Bhagavan, if a good man or good woman should take the bodhisattva path to enlightenment, how should they live? How should they stand and walk? And how should they control their minds and thoughts? Yes, I saw. I really saw. But I'm still in doubt, because I'm not sure how to get there. How do we really do this? How do we live? How do we deal with our minds, our thoughts, desires, dislikes, and all the rest of us? Subhuti asks for himself and for all the rest of the assembly and for each of us as well. For in reading and reciting and studying this sutra, we are in the presence of this assembly and the Buddha, along with all beings. And Buddha says, good, Subhuti, very good. It is as you say. The teacher validates the student's insight. Now, in the Zen sect, we usually demand a demonstration beyond words. But words are okay if they are not only true, but the truth itself, like this sutra. So Buddha says, yes, good. You've truly seen. It is as you say. It is the truth. Teacher and student are in accord. The Buddha recognizes that Subhuti has seen, and that he is now ready to follow and understand the full teaching, something that was not possible before. So now, yes, listen carefully, and we will go the rest of the way. We will go all the way. Many of us have had a glimpse, a taste, and as we continue our practice, we are going the rest of the way. We are going all the way, beyond space, beyond time. There is no end to practice, nor beginning of enlightenment, no end of enlightenment, no beginning of practice. Together with all beings, we realize the way.